Stay tuned to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. You may be left speechless.
Help! 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 Oh, you mad?
Still.
We're the Shangri-Las, and when we're in Ann Arbor, we listen to WCBN FM Ann Arbor.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Raiders on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have in the studio with me Chico McMurtry. Chico, welcome to Living Raiders. Welcome to the studio.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for coming down here today to be here in person with us. And before we get started, I'd like to thank all the listeners, everybody out there. Fundraiser was last week, and we had a great time. George Cooper was here, Lillian Lee, Stephanie Douglas Carpenter, our lovely engineer, Ali Shapiro stopped by. We had a call in by Jim Shepard, and then we had a call in by Gina Brandolino too. So thanks for everybody out there in the community, also for calling in and supporting your community radio station, Living Raiders. So I'd like to thank Angie Berkeley, Carol Tell, Sammy Bernier, Jay and Connie Simrod, Lewis, The Liz, Gina Brandolino, Harry Freed, and Sally Hetzel. Ooh, and Ellen too. And I'd like to announce the grand winner of Lillian Lee's debut novel. Let me get the word out. Novel. Number one Chinese restaurant. So Lillian Lee came here and she had an advanced reader's copy of the book and brought it with her, signed it to one lucky listener, and that lucky listener is, oh shoot, we should have had a drum roll somehow, right? Harry Freed. So Harry, you will have a copy of Lillian Lee's signed book, Number One Chinese Restaurant, heading to you shortly. And thanks again to everyone out there for pledging, being part of it. And thanks for listening today. Been so excited to talk with you, Chico. Chico McMurtry is here. You have a current residency now. How long are you going to be in town for still? Like, because lots has been going on. You've been super busy.
Yeah, sure. It ends this Friday. And actually, I'll be at the gallery at the Humanity Center all day Friday. And I wanted to continue to work on these drawings that are very much a part of the narrative that I'm trying to develop with the Border Crosser Project. So my students will be there as well. So we'll meet there the whole day. And then after that, I think at 6 p.m., I'll present some of my earlier films that I made in the early 80s, and one of which was in the Ann Arbor Film Festival, actually. So that's happening on Friday night, starting at 6
p.m.?
Yep.
And as you'll be there all day? Is the public also welcome to
Absolutely.
Come by?
Absolutely. It's open to the public, yeah.
So all day. I think the doors might open like at 10 o'clock or so.
I
Is that
so.
What we're thinking?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That sounds civilized too, doesn't it?
Right.
Too early.
Yeah.
So that'll be Friday at the Institute of Humanities. And of course, you've been here. You've given a Penny Stamps lecture.
That's right.
And so, you know what, without further ado, I'll read your bio and then let's talk about the project, the work
sure.
you've been doing, if you don't mind. Chico McMurtry is an award-winning artist, renowned internationally for his large-scale robotic sculpture, whose work combines materiality and robotics, the visceral and conceptual. McMurtry is the artistic director of Amorphic Robot Works, an interdisciplinary creative collective located in Brooklyn, New York. And also in Arizona.
Yeah, in Bisbee, Arizona.
Which is more recent, right? As a,
right.
a second location.
It's more of a... I grew up there, actually, so I've sort of reestablished a creative base where it all began.
And was it actually your home?
It's the ranch I grew up in.
It is.
And so I restored it into a studio, and I work out of there a lot of the year.
Oh, wow. You have such interesting workspaces because in Brooklyn, you have a Norwegian Siemens church.
That's right.
Uh-huh. How did...
Today it's known as the Robotic Church.
Oh, of course. Yes, of course. I know. Norway can have the Winter Olympics, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They can't have this.
Yeah.
They can't have the Robotic Church. So let's talk about border crossings and the project that you've been... The work you've been doing here,
sure.
if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
What's it been like? What have you been up to these last couple of weeks?
Well, it's been a full-on effort to bring this team of students, which were 16 of them, up to speed. First we had to get them to learn how to build. So there was this two-week intensive for them to get permission to use the facility in engineering to be able to contribute to the building part. The whole time, many of the students participated in sort of the design phases, and then...
And these, the drawings that you were mentioning earlier?
The drawings and figuring out how to make the things and bring all of the designs together. Many of the students worked with Louisa, who's worked with me for many years now. Louisa Funk was heading up the inflatable building. So that was several students stuck close to her, and everybody got a chance to do that. So... And then the 3 days prior to the performance, everything was coming together simultaneously. So everything was sort of culminating in a moment and many, many late nights and a lot of fatigue and all of that.
Actually, I think we were supposed to speak two Wednesdays ago.
All right.
And because of some things that were happening
with
the work.
Right. It was impossible at that time.
Yes. So such is the way of the making and the artist.
It's the way of the making, yeah. And so not knowing how everything was going to play out at the time, it you just have to sort of go with the flow. And so we continued. And so ultimately, I think we got this new machine, I would say 80% like what we were after, which was an amazing achievement considering what we were up against.
Because it's so large scale as well. Is that part
That's right.
of the challenge?
The scale, it was a 24-foot high, machine, and our earlier one was 18 feet high. So, and then just, you know, getting it under computer control, and one student was focused on the control of the inflatable, and two students were in control of the building and creating of the vehicle control, and there was the building of the vehicle, and there was, you know, putting it all together, and just, you know, by the time we brought it to life the first night, it was way too large for the space we were working in. We couldn't fully inflate it, you know. So the first test was literally out in front of the museum, and then there was 60-mile-an-hour winds that attacked the machine and...
Is this the part of the organic part?
It's very much part of the organic part. So that first test was really raw but the great thing is that the wind ripped it apart, and then we put it back together live in front of an audience, and then brought it up yet another time. So it was quite successful in that regard.
that almost seems more successful.
Sure.
Like hearing you tell the story of it.
Well, success is so much about failure, you know, and learning is about failure. So you have to really get knocked down in order to get back up again.
Ripped apart even.
Yeah, and come up with clarity and better ideas.
And the nature of like the theme that this project is also is exploring, mm-hmm. the idea of borders, how that also feels something, I don't know, that feels resonant there too. Like this idea of like things are, well, I don't know. I was thinking that where like there's gotta be this tearing down. I don't necessarily think then we need to build up a border again, but I guess if the work of what you are, I think, making here is to think about what is the, I don't know, actually, why don't you talk about it, Chico? Because you're here. Better for you to talk about it than me. Because it's like that liminal space, right? And crossing and transforming borders.
I think the origin of the idea, it's also parallel to having begun this work with inflatables 10 years ago. But going back to my childhood, I went to school in a town called Naco, N-A-C-O, Arizona. And it bordered Naco, Sonora, Mexico. So our school was nice, and there was a heavy, sort of heavy Latin population anyways, but our many children came through the fence to go to school with us. And the fence was a chain link fence, and it had a big hole, you know.
As they do.
Yeah, yeah.
Perfect.
So just, you know, people walked through, and they were welcomed, and those kids, you know, ended up immigrating or not immigrating or what have you, but I was, you know, an Irish-Mexican kid, friends with the Caucasian kids, friends with the Mexican kids. And I saw myself right in the middle, and I was just watching everything. And so I was always the observer. And I think it's just, you know, when I went away and came, you know, went to school, came back every year, this border slowly got, you know, more and more fortified. And all of my relatives immigrated in the 30s and 40s, and they came because they were skilled workers, and they got immigrated, and they became citizens and all that stuff. They came from Mexico. So it's like these things just weren't making sense to me, and then I just thought over and over again, it's this lack of unity between the humans that's being divided by this hard barrier. And I just thought about this notion. The first drawing of a border crossing sort of bridge form originated 10 years ago. And so as time went on and I was able to develop this craft of these inflatable architectural structures, I found the need to make this border crossing structure and ultimately make it so that it could actually be autonomous and be deployed in different places around the world. And not just the borders, but in places where communities are divided and there's a need for unity. So I'm sort of after this symbol that can sort of define this lack of unity and a symbol of sort of peace and elegance and humanity. You know, that's kind of what I'm after.
That's no small thing.
No, in fact, it's rather large.
Yes. And so if folks listening, if you want to go to amorphicrobotworks.org, you'll be able to see some visuals, too, of what we're talking about today. And so, Chico, for the visual of this, is this structure, is the structure one where it's almost like there is an arch, but there's also pieces that are crisscrossing it, and it's inflatable. So as it goes up, could you describe
sure.
it just briefly?
It's sort of as if you imagine a scissor lift in your mind, and then take that scissor lift, put it into Photoshop, and distort it into a curve. That's a good way of looking at it. And then instead of it being metal, it's made out of inflatable tubes. So the material that I use is a high tensile fabric, and we've developed a system in which we can use this fabric while it's inflated as kind of a linkage. So we're able to sort of duplicate what the metal would be doing in this scissor lift, except it's all inflatable. So it's a fraction of the weight, and when the whole thing collapses, not only can it reduce itself in size, but you can completely deflate it, and it just becomes this sort of pile of fabric with no form. So ultimately, you can really compress it and make it very small.
And then, therefore, achieving, like, the portability.
The portability.
Too, mm-hmm. So that you can move it around to different locations in the world. So you've
That's
brought
right.
it here. Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk about also where it's been and where it's going.
Okay.
Today on the program, Chico McMurtry is here. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Stephanie behind the glass. We'll be back.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring, bound by wild desire. I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. The taste of love is sweet when hearts like ours meet. I fell for you like a child. Oh, but the fire went wild. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm glad you did. Today on Living Writers, Chico McMurtry is here. Chico McMurtry has been in town. The Institute for Humanities has sponsored his residency, live robotic border crossers performances, working with students. This coming Friday at the Institute of Humanities, an all day, starting around 10 a.m., we think, an all day event where you can come by and see the drawings and other artifacts of the project, mm-hmm. and talk with Chico McMurtry, his students, and at 6 p.m., films from the 80s. So going back to see, like, kind of the inception of how this all started.
Sure, yeah, that's right.
So can you tell us, thanks for picking the songs for today's show.
Okay.
What about why the Johnny Cash?
Oh, so Nikki, one of the engineering students who was working on control of the sort of vehicle, he picked that today because the vehicle actually caught fire a few times before we were actually able to take it out. So, you know, in addition to many of the things that we had on our plate at the same time, yeah, the vehicle caught fire. So that's mainly why that song appeared. Just a little humorous note.
And is that something that's happened before during when you've brought?
No, actually, nothing's ever caught fire before, and that I can recall. And so, in this case, it was just because we were taking on something so complex, and there was some levels of, you know, running it with battery and a metal frame and all these things. There were some precautions that we were taking, but there were a few mistakes made, and so.
And no one was hurt.
Nobody was hurt.
No one was hurt in the making of the border crossing installation.
No, just a few scrapes and bruised shins when the vehicle just kind of plowed into people a little bit, but that was it.
That was okay. Yeah. And a thrilling, that's what makes it memorable too, right?
Of course.
And the not knowing, I think, I think I was watching on your site, amorphicrobotworks.org, a short video, and you were saying I was struck by, you said the not knowing what I need as being part of the process.
Right.
It's not knowing. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I think probably the most thrilling part of being an artist, I think, is not knowing, because it's a healthy thing to not know, because you get an idea and you don't know how to achieve it, and so there ends up being this process of research and applying what you already know. But I think when you're trying to create something new for the first time, it's like that's the sort of the most important aspect of having a practice as an artist. So, I mean, if you're just building things and you have all the solutions worked out, there's no process, no fun. And that's why I think the engineering is a really important aspect of what I do. And sometimes things can be way too engineered and there's not a moment to find something more lucid or more relaxed. And but I also think that it's a very intriguing it's a very intriguing part of the process.
So the engineering part, when you were saying because you need that in order to realize, like what we were talking about, the scale of these projects are big, and you've been working with for machines. Did your work with machines start back in the 80s? Because I loved looking at the robotic church, where I could see these sculptures that you had made. Is it Tumbling Man? Could you talk about how that was, that sort of maybe part of the origin story, and then this project and the inflatables grew out of that? Or
absolutely. I mean, I had been exploring performance with my body when I was studying earlier, dance and martial arts and all of these things. And that led me to making sort of life-size puppets that eventually became robotic sculptures, right? So my body and what I went through with my body taught me how to make machines. And then each of the machines in turn taught the next machine, because I figured out how to do something, and that became part of the process that gave birth to the next machine, which gave birth to the next machine. And eventually there was a room full of machines, and then it became about how do they communicate. And then the work became about the onset of communication through sound and body movement. And that was all – that began to be stitched together with essentially sound recording software, which was completely akin to movement, because sound and movement always go together. So we were using music software to begin – to activate these machines to communicate with each other. And that became the core of what the performances became.
And they were able to read from, like, each machine was cued by the specific sounds or soundscape?
No, not necessarily. What I meant to say is that...
Oh, did they produce the sound?
We used MIDI as a means to MIDI control and keyboard. So we would literally play a machine live with a keyboard and record that and build soundtracks by driving the machines live, as if I was picking your hand up to hit a drum, and I attached you to an actuator, and your hand fell on the drum, and the rate at which your hand fell on the drum became the rhythms or the non-rhythms, the soundscape.
So when you and then there was a time where it seemed like there was a break, if I'm understanding the story, these particular machines weren't being used, and then you were going to get married and you decided to like bring them back to life or so, or resuscitate them.
Sure.
In a way.
Well, the story was that I went off to, I started doing this other work, which was the inflatables, let's say, and my work was being stored by my agent who was in Munich, and these things had toured many, many years and throughout Europe from venue to venue, and then they were just being stored and the container was getting eaten up by the weather, and I had to make this move to rescue them, and it just was parallel to meeting my wife and deciding to get married. And I thought, if I'm going to in fact get married, it's got to be really good. And I decided I had to get married three times, in fact, not just once.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because three times is the charm, right? So three times. And then we brought these machines back to the church, and they all were under the knife and they got restored to their original form. And we found the rhythms, and we brought the rhythms back, the old sequences, and we brought them back to life as they originally were.
And so when you talk about it, like, were you really bringing them back to life? Like, because it feels like you are.
Well, certainly, yeah. I mean, it's like if you lose your memory and you go find it and you bring that memory back, then you have it again, right? So in this case, their physical actions and their memories were reunified, and we were able to bring them back. So the interesting thing is, on a spiritual plane or a spiritual level, I then deem them all officially saints. And each of those robotic saints was able to have its own pew in the walls of the church. We completely restored the church, not to its original form, but to an interpretation of what its original form would have been. So we restored the interior of this derelict building, and then we created a new church, and it was their church. It was the robotic church.
And they're the saints in it.
They're the saints.
And this is in Brooklyn.
They're a miracle that they work, in fact.
So many levels, right? and this robotic church is in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, can people go in and see the saints?
Sure.
Come to life, yeah, again, and what they're meant to be.
That's right.
When do you do it? Like, when do you decide?
This spring we're going to have a new season of the robotic church, and so we've been doing it every a couple times a year and in special events. And when somebody really requests to see them, we go ahead and turn them on.
I don't know about you, Stephanie, but I would like to request to see them. So please let us.
If you come into town, no problem. We'll do it.
That would be brilliant. Yeah. And so these robotic saints, then your work morphed into the inflatables, and there were the bird inflatables, like the series.
Mm-hmm.
Was that when you were part of it, when your physicality, because you mentioned earlier how the motion and the physicality of your body was part of the performance in the original work. In the inflatables, was that also, because I feel like I've seen video of you within them, and
sure.
It was that the bird? And was
I think what happened was I was after a softer humanoid machine. And the machines had been hard, but they had various qualities of gesture. They had a awkward and elegance, and they had a wide range of stuff. But they didn't have the softness that we're imbued with as humans. You know, the ability for our face to fall into our hand and meld as a unified form that's just human. So I was after what it is to be human, not like what, say, Japanese roboticists are pursuing, where they're trying to make a realistic, because you still can't believe it, because it's stiff and it's awkward and it might be hyper realistic, but it doesn't matter. It's not human. It doesn't feel human. So that was the driving interest in trying to make the soft machine. I wanted to be able to perform with a machine, you know, that I could take the weight of this machine with my body and move with it, or it could take my body's weight and move with it. So it was those kinds of things that I was after, and certainly art's driven by these sort of desires that are unreachable. It was really unreachable. It wasn't practical. So on one level, this humanoid machine just led me astray, and I began, as I developed these muscles with the soft fabric, I fell upon this idea by accident of this. I had to make a giant bird because I was invited to fill a giant space. And they expected a bunch of my metal robots, and all I had was a suitcase full of fabric and these tiny little muscles I had been working on. So
a wingspan.
I built a 60-foot wingspan bird that filled this huge factory that died when the wall came down in 1989, right? And this factory in the background was a clock at the moment that the wall came down, and this bird just moved through move through the space.
So was this in Berlin?
It was in Dresden.
Oh, in Dresden. Okay.
Yeah, and that was like the turning point. I had to build this thing to fill the space, and it was this bird. So then that led to the 16 bird installation, and then it was very much about reflecting what happens in nature and the life cycle and repetition of form, and ultimately these birds they showed around the world, and it was I had kind of hit on something, but it wasn't completely what I was after, because after all it was an accident. And then but what I didn't recognize about the birds is that when they collapsed, when they started to die and be void of form, it reminded me of architecture collapsing. And then I was like, wow, if I could connect these birds together and start to form inflatable architecture, that was how it evolved. And so I started working on ways in which to interconnect these tubes and these forms and get them to do even more complicated things. So basically I overcomplicated things for myself, and the struggle was to find ways in which to connect these things and in an ever lighter way. And several, you know, you can look at the evolution of those pieces. Of course, every piece taught the next. And then by the time we got to the currently up to the border crossers, I made several versions of these border crossers, some lighter, some less controllable, some, you know. And ultimately, the thing we're working on now came about over the last few years of evolution. So,
let's take a short break, and then can we talk about the border crossers and the evolution?
Sure.
That would be okay. Today on Living Writers, Chico McMurtry is here. A Morphic Robot Works. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
De la noche en San Salvador, El Salvador.
11 de la noche en Managua, Nicaragua.
Me gustan los aviones, me gustas tú. Me gusta viajar, me gustas tú. Me gusta la mañana, me gustas tú. Me gusta el viento, me gustas tú. Me gusta soñar, me gustas tú. Me gusta la mar, me gustas tú. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais pas. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais plus.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, so glad you did. Today on the program, Chico McMurtry is here of Morphic Robot Works. And we've got Stephanie behind the glass. Do you mind saying what you just said, Chico?
Oh, gosh. Well, can you remind me what I just said?
Oh, about Stephanie.
Oh, she seems really special.
She is. She's the best.
Both
so
of you are
lucky.
Like, both of your eyes are twinkling.
Oh.
With huge smiles.
The magic of radio.
Yeah. You're very fluid together.
Well, and thanks for joining us today.
Sure.
It's great to have you come down for a conversation. Really mm-hmm. appreciate it. And to be on campus to talk about these ideas and bring the work. And I can only imagine that for those 16 students, life-changing, like taking part in this project. Anyway, but let's get back to the border crossers, mm-hmm. right? So this, we're just at the break, the evolution of it. So can we go back to that moment?
Sure. I guess the little introduction of with Mano Chao is interesting because of the it at times, you know, even though there's this border dividing Mexico and America, there's this festive quality of the Mexican culture that's sort of uncomparable, you know. And if you're in Mexico and you're looking at the border wall, they're often painted bright colors, you know, because they're not going to have any of this, like, doldrum that's being imposed on them. You know?
That a wall implies.
Yeah, a wall implies. You know, my history, I'm not positive, but, like, I remember it being like 1910. where I grew up was Mexico at the time, and where I was born in New Mexico was Mexico at the time, and California was not, you know, California, and Texas was Texas, you know.
Right.
So I mean, not that it was those names, but that was Mexico in 1910. This treaty changed everything, and the war changed everything, and so it was taken, and so I just think it's intriguing if you go to. The food of choice in any of those states is Mexican food, first of all. The culture is Latino, and it's second generation. I mean, you could call it Chicano. You could look at the lowrider culture that's about this affinity for cars and culture and the marking and the look. And so those states really have that influence, and you just can't take it away. And so... But what is taken away is the fence takes away the ability for those people to link and communicate with their families, you know, in an open way. And they're restricted by their level of wealth or poverty or what have you. So there's all of these issues that are part of being on the border. But so back to this notion of the border crossing machine. As I went down and I noticed this border off, you know, more and more, it became clear to me that there was something really wrong. That not only, from my point of view, not only is this restricting their ability to communicate with each other, these people who live here and have been here their whole lives with their relatives, but you know, people have died trying to come. You know, come over the border and trying to survive this change of life. And literally they've undisputably given to our economy because they're doing the work that other people might not have wanted to do. And they're able to go and feed, they're able to send money back and feed their culture in the country that's right next to us, right? So there's all these complex levels of what is and what isn't, you know. And then you simply look at the gross national product of Mexico giving to America, especially the border towns. It's phenomenal. It's like it's really a huge amount of money. Mexico gives the border towns huge amounts of money. The 350,000 people who live in Agua Prieta next to Douglas, Arizona, 350,000 people keep the 5,000 people in America alive by the sheer fact that they go to the Walmart, that they go to the Dairy Queen, that they go to the gas station, that they cross over and spend money, mm-hmm. They keep that little town alive, and it's sort of undisputable. And it's like that's something that's not even seen.
So why is that? Like, that's okay because bringing money in.
Yeah, I mean, you're allowed if you have money, allowed to cross back and forth.
You're always allowed yeah. to cross.
So it's sort of like this injustice that continues on. I mean, in many ways, but at the So I see all these things as I grow up and I go back and forth and I just think about what can you do other than just respond in an honest way. And the way I just think about this symbol, this form, this symbol of a bridge, of an arc, of elegance to symbolize the need for unity. Or look, people, this is really okay that... You know, that these humans can participate and be together once again, or that their families can unify and not be, you know, sent back and et cetera, et cetera. So that's how it came about. And so, like I said, I've been talking about it, working on the idea for many years. And so now is thanks to the Guggenheim for jumpstarting, the Guggenheim Fellowship for jumpstarting the project, I was able to develop the first one. And then coming here to Ann Arbor and being invited by Amanda Cuglier, it's like she saw the importance of trying to give it another bump, you know. And so we've been able to come close to completing the second one, and then that's leading to the third one, which would lead to the fourth one. And ultimately, just the vision is to see several of these at the same moment forming this shape across the border. And if that made enough, if that brought enough attention to itself, perhaps it could trigger something. who knows?
Maybe start some more conversations,
sure,
too, and bring attention to it on a where people would be thinking about the art critically as well. And think, you know, so to be thinking about it in conversation and the, sure, ideas that it's generating. What? So where will the third, where will you do the third one, Chico?
Well, I'm not positive yet, but I'm you know, I'm interested in, there's several possibilities opening up and maybe in Buffalo, New York, maybe in Mexico, maybe in the next one won't be till, I teach a workshop in Vienna with students in Europe. And I just sort of go where it takes me.
So you'll build one in Vienna as well then?
Certainly, yeah. I've been invited to do that with students. So it expands into Europe, and then, you know, in a way we're much larger in the size of America, but in Europe they've been facing this the whole time. Next year is the 30th anniversary of the, you know, the Berlin Wall coming down. 30 years next year.
Can it be?
Yeah. So what is you know, the importance of that to this whole part of the world? And now as we look, pay attention, see what's happening, walls are going up everywhere, divisions are continuing and happening again, and the unity is you know, Europe is losing unity in a lot of ways, and they're trying to find ways to stay together. But so because there's so many more countries, there's so many more possibilities for these divisions and so on.
And I think it's also interesting to me that as part of the mission of the project, it feels like it is like we are talking about national boundaries and borders, and you so eloquently were describing how the border between Mexico and U.S. has been a fluid thing. It's in our lifetimes, not, but that doesn't mean like the geographic lifetime of the land or so, and the landscape itself. And I love how there's ideas of there's borders and there's boundaries and there's blur economically. So we've been talking about those who have money and those who don't, and how you were saying these border crossers, these machines, these robots, they can be placed into communities to try and heal other questions, other wounds. How do you see that with these? Because we've been talking about it,
yeah,
just, more related to like geographic or political boundaries or nation states.
I think just once, you know, the biggest issue is like manifesting them, making them real, and then they would be available to travel and do things and help. So I just see the possibility of their adventures maybe being endless. You know, it's like a character creating a character that goes and performs, you know. And originally I saw them, you know, 10 years ago I made drawings of them in and around New York City and throughout the different boroughs. And it was just like the divisions between boroughs and neighborhoods is amazing. And even touching on that is important. And that was at the, you know, at the key of the idea, the origin of the idea. So it has endless possibilities, you know. And the division of Morocco and Spain, for instance, there's a whole Spanish sponsorship of the project too, which is interesting, you know, because there's German and Spanish sponsorship of a project that's going on in America, and so there's you know, these curators from Europe see this idea of what's happening in America is kind of astonishing, and from their point of view, you know, this notion of the border and what it represents. I wanted to touch on one thing, which is the Mexican population that started coming in the 90s to all the major cities in New York and built the buildings and ran the restaurants and did all this work. The amount of them wanting to come back is diminished extensively, right? So the amount of interest in the Mexicans coming over to work in America has slowed way down, and they're just not interested. And it's like, but yet we're like
But know, that's not the narrative that some places that's not the narrative are, that's being placed. Are,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
To manipulate people into
thinking otherwise. And the bottom line is the people who are coming over from that part of the world are escaping wars and extreme poverty, and it's not necessarily Mexico anymore, you know? So it's you know, it's intriguing, you know, that Mexico is the border, and Mexico is the border that's stopping a lot of, you know, all of these things for America. You know, it is a place that's stopping things from entering in a way by the nature of being supposedly our ally.
Right. yes, ally, neighbor.
Right.
And now more wall is more being wall. It doesn't make any sense.
But I mean, but certainly weapons are available to go over to that side, which is one of the biggest importers. American weapons to Mexico are helping lead this high astonishing level of death and corruption is being, yeah, you know,
the wall is porous in so
right.
many
oh it's
ways.
Porous in one direction, sure.
Let's take a short break and then we'll come back. Today on Living Writers, Chico McMurtry is here. Amorphic Robot Works. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. Today on the program, Chico McMurtry is here, Amorphic Robot Works. And you'll be able to also listen to this conversation again on the Living Writers website if you choose, and check out the Living Writers Instagram later for pictures of Chico McMurtry here in the studio with his notebook, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But first, could we talk about some of the, how does the tech work to make
sure.
this idea, the border crossers work?
Okay, sure. At the core of the project is a series of onboard computers. This vehicle is would be at its completion a completely autonomous electric powered machine. So what that means is it's basically a series of 12-volt batteries are connected together to run a series of valves, some blowers, a winch motor, and the electric motors that drive the wheels.
Because the blowers are necessary for the air to inflate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the valves are necessary to channel the air to different passages. And so that's all being controlled by what is now commonly known as the Arduino, which is an off-the-shelf computer that's been around as part of the sort of revolution of computing for everybody. Everybody can pick up an Arduino and learn how to use it and, you know, make themselves toast and run their bath and all that kind of stuff, you know, if they want. And many schools teach how to use the Arduino. And in this case, we use software that's been around, that's been evolving for quite a while. One of them is called Processing, which is an available online version of Max MSP, which is a purchasable one, which is often used in studio formats and the music industry, let's say. But we use that, and Bill Bowen, who's worked with me for many years developing the hardware and software of these machines, developed a system for the inflatable. And then, like I said, some of these engineering students developed a system to navigate this machine. So all of this stuff comes together, and the idea is that we can, drive this machine to the border and release it. And, you know, it goes to its location, and then we deploy it to ARC, to go to its full height and then come back and, you know, expand and retract as it may.
And when you're imagining this too, is it that the machine will also drive across the border? For example, if there wasn't a fence or a wall there, would the machine cross it and then turn around and put the arch back? Or like what are you imagining for this?
I haven't imagined that yet, but you have a good imagination. So the idea is just to essentially find a way to get, you know, if you're 15 feet away from the border, you'll be able to cross a 30-foot arc.
Right.
And if the fence is, that's basically it. It doesn't have to touch the other side necessarily. And if all goes well and it's, it can just bring itself back up without any incident.
Right. Hope for no high winds.
No high winds, right, yeah. Although it's been built for wind conditions. It's just at a certain point, you just can't deploy it under winds that are too high.
Yeah. So. I know the feeling.
Yeah, that's right. That's basically how it works.
That's amazing. And I love also how when you're explaining it, the interplay of what the practical side and the dream side. Mm-hmm. So like how do you do something that you're imagining? And you have to be able to imagine more that what's been done before or building on what you've done before.
That's
like
right.
You've been saying each machine teaches the next machine. But that you're also so open and see how necessary the engineers are to make the practical realizable. Like you're both so necessary to this project.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Very much so.
So that the, I think that's, I don't know. There's, so in your career as an artist, your path so far, do you feel like it's always been a collaborative component in your work?
I think when I was younger and I was first discovering making machines, I was certainly on my own. And then I recognized my late brother was an engineer, and he always encouraged me to befriend other engineers and talk about these things. We always talked about these things together. And so I took his advice on it, and I just started seeking out engineers who were interested in working with me on these crazy ideas. And I think the reason why the art and science collaboration, art engineering collaboration is important is because engineering is really, it's a straightforward, rigid kind of, you have to complete a task. You have to do it in a logical way, and so if you introduce art to that, it throws that whole thing for a tangent. You're having to sort of, there's a lot of challenges for an engineer to work with an artist. Therefore, the engineer grows because they've been challenged more off of their trajectory, and vice versa. So, for an artist whose, ideas might be unreachable, to converse with an engineer, it becomes more practical and more reachable. And so there's this really great interplay, I think, and it's a historic thing. It's continued to happen through history, and some of the greatest large-scale sculptures and performances there's been always a contribution of an engineer in there, and often they go unseen in a way, but I think it's really important, and it continues to be more important as we go on into the future, because ultimately artists are seeking to do something that hasn't happened before, and there's a lot that hasn't happened and is more achievable or reachable today than ever before.
So what are some of those ideas that are in your notebook then? Like, what have you, because you carried this in here today and it's been on the table.
Well, sure. Just like, I think, you know, every page of this notebook is sort of dedicated to even a single component, how to make a single component and how everything, all of these single components become part of the bigger whole. And I think when everything gets down to sort of the nitty gritty and right before the delivery of the artwork, I find myself going to the pencil and paper because it's a more responsive and pure way to communicate with myself and keep track of my brain and what needs to be done rather than my iPhone, you know. So if I can keep this in my pocket, I can visualize what I'm after, and then that really helps to complete the projects and check things off. I'm like, I did do that, check it off. Your brain, you know, under pressure and all that, you're all over the place. But at the core of everybody's notebook is the purity of the ideas. You can find that one sketch that was the most lucid of all. And if you keep drawing, that's why I encourage all art students, even if they're specializing in design and don't draw at all anymore in the notebook, to keep a notebook, because the connection between writing and a visual idea is the purest part of your practice. So it's important to keep. Well, just because you might have that moment when you're sitting on a bench or somewhere and you don't have your laptop, your most modern device, and to go ahead and turn on the digital device and try to express yourself in your digital device, you're taking away from that moment. And pencil on paper is still pure, I feel. You can keep it, put it in your pocket, put it next to your heart or whatever, and it's just more lucid. And I think that's something that you can't keep, you know, you got to keep track of. You have to keep track of your ideas. So.
And so for your old notebooks, because this one, you can see it's well-loved. Are your old notebooks somewhere where you can still find them? You can map out your ideas?
Yeah, they're archived, and you can just go back and, you know, find the doodle that's at the origin of the idea. And that's, and then when the drawing was lucid, or when there was a purity of the idea, it's in there.
Thank you.
So years pass sometimes.
Thank you, Chico.
You're welcome.
Thanks for talking with all of us today.
Sure.
And living writers. Chico McMurtry, amorphicrobotworks.org. This Friday at the Institute of Humanities, 10 a.m. onward, 6 p.m., film start, films from Chico's work in the 80s. Thanks again to everyone for fundraiser. Thanks to George Cooper for his song Maybe. That's the new theme for Living Writers. Yeah, and Chico, thanks. Come back anytime.
Sure.
Let's keep talking.
Okay.
Chico McMurtry today on Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
You live 3,000.